Song is called "The Devil in Me." Figured that that kind of sort of fit our conversation tonight. The group is the 2220s English Rockers from a place called Lincolnshire, which I'm sure my guest Nick Redfern knows where that is. He's here to talk about his new book, "Secret History: Conspiracies, Ancient Aliens to the New World Order." There's a lot of stuff in between, such as who was Jack the Ripper, and what's the deal on L. Ron Hubbard getting abducted and shot up with medicine? And is there a connection between the murders of Robert Kennedy and John Lennon? We're going to touch on as many of these conspiracy theories and ideas as we can in our next segment of Coast to Coast AM. Stay right there. I should mention that one of the reasons people like me get into journalism is so they don't have to do math. As a couple of listeners have pointed out, the anniversary of the Trinity test coming up is the 70th anniversary, not the 60th anniversary. Before we leave that, though, Nick Redfern, it's amazing that they could blow up an atomic bomb in the state of New Mexico and get away with it by giving a cover story, isn't it?
It's sort of an intriguing little bit of history. A lot of people may not know is that the first Trinity, or the first, I should say, atomic bomb test at the Trinity site was undertaken in overwhelming secrecy. And you're right, the idea of exploding an atomic bomb on U.S. soil, and it was actually successfully hidden. It sounds too good to be true, but that is exactly what happened. You have this cover story put into place, and people just accepted it. And it demonstrates, if you can hide an atomic bomb explosion, I mean, not for sort of sinister reasons. It was just, the war was going on. Obviously, we didn't want the Germans to know or the Japanese to know what potentially was going to go down. But, it does show the sheer extent to how easy it is to hide events of significant proportions.
Yeah, not only in plain sight, but really big in plain sight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's touch on a couple of things. I know there's no way we can cover everything you have in this, but we'll touch on a couple of really interesting ones. A little bit different from what we normally talk about on the program is Jack the Ripper. You go through a whole bunch of theories about who he might have been, and you end up, though, with some fairly recent new information.
Yeah, there's a number of theories as to who Jack the Ripper was. His killings occurred in late 1888 in the Whitechapel area of London, which back then, was sort of very foggy little back streets and winding alleyways and, where anything could go down and pretty much did. And over the years, numerous theories have been put forward as to who Jack the Ripper possibly was. And, they range from more conventional scenarios of, a normal, well, actually normal, so like a deranged serial killer, right up to the idea of a member of the British royal family, connections to the Masons, even the Jill the Ripper theory, namely that it was a woman, possibly a midwife or something along those lines. And what's interesting about the Jack the Ripper story is that for years there have been rumors of high-level cover-ups and conspiracies in relation to who Jack the Ripper was, or even concerns about who he was. They may not even been true, but if certain people in the government and the royal family thought there could even be an inkling that Jack the Ripper was known to somebody in the royal family who was even connected, that might have been reason enough for some sort of cover-up to be put in place. But certainly, the most intriguing developments occurred in September 2014, revolved a man named Aaron Kosminski. And he was someone who, over the years, has been put forward as a potential strong candidate. He lived in the area, Whitechapel, where the murders took place. He had a degree of psychological disturbance, mental illness. And even the local police at the time of the investigation had pointed the finger at him as potentially being the culprit. And there were certain DNA developments in 2014 where evidence of Kosminski's DNA was actually found on the clothing of a woman named Catherine Eddowes, who was one of Jack the Ripper's victims. Now, other people who suggested different theories have said, well, because she was a prostitute, maybe, he got it from in that sense, he went with prostitutes. But on the other hand, could he have been the killer? He could. But it doesn't conclusively prove anything, but it does demonstrate a new and intriguing angle in the case.
I mean, wow, they've got DNA evidence from a guy who was a prime suspect. That's pretty strong compared to, there's no other physical evidence at all, is there?
No, you're right, there isn't. There's a lot of rumors and stories and theories and things like that, but this is really the most intriguing development, without doubt, in the last few years. And as I said, there are people who've sort of questioned, what it actually means or implies or doesn't. But, I don't think, unless something really unusual happens, I don't think we're going to get a stronger candidate right now, at least.
Let's jump to another really interesting chapter. A lot of attention focused on Scientology these days because of a documentary. HBO has aired it. Yeah. All the just wild, crazy stuff that the Scientologists believe. A lot of crazy stuff about L. Ron Hubbard. You've just piled on in this. I had never heard this stuff about him being basically abducted.
Well, I guess it depends how you define abducted. But, I mean, one of the things I talk about in relation to, the main thing I talk about in relation to Scientology is something very strange that happened in the early 1950s. And this is something that's related in L. Ron Hubbard's FBI file, which has now been declassified through the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. He talked about, or sort of complained officially about, how in one particular February 1951 morning in the early hours, somebody broke into his home and essentially stuck a needle into him. Now, there were rumors about it being to try and create like a coronary thrombosis, and then he mentioned about also being given an electric shock. But the basic thrust of it was that somebody came into his apartment and injected him with something. Now, why this is intriguing is because this was actually a tactic used in some of the early mind control operations of MKUltra and some of the sub-projects. Well, it turns out that, another man in that same era, a man named Carl Hunrath, who was from Wisconsin but moved to LA in the early 50s, who was sort of an early player in the UFO research field, he complained to the authorities that a very human-looking person, or claimed to be an extraterrestrial but very human-looking, broke into his home in 1951 and 1952 and injected something into him. Now, where he gets even weird is that Hunrath was an associate of a man named Kenneth Goff, who was Kenneth Goff was an interesting guy. He was an evangelist preacher, and he believed that there was like a plan in place by some sort of shadow agency to create a faked alien invasion. And it kind of sounds like a 1950s equivalent of the controversial Project Bluebeam scenario that people talk about today, like a staged event to create a new world order. But Kenneth Goff was talking about this back in the 50s, and Kenneth Goff himself was somebody else who complained about characters breaking into his home and injecting him with chemicals in the middle of the night. It turns out that Goff, in a roundabout way, actually knew L. Ron Hubbard and had contact with him. So you have these various people all involved in different aspects of the UFO phenomenon. Of course, Scientology has a major alien aspect to it as well. All talking about people breaking it in, injecting them with something. And, I sort of talk about that, the angle, could it have been some sort of MKUltra program to sort of reinforce the UFO angle for some obscure project, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, you speculate that after this incident that L. Ron Hubbard reports, that that's when he starts getting really interested and obsessed with aliens. And
Hubbard was an interesting guy because, prior to Scientology, he created Dianetics, and before that, he was hanging out with Jack Parsons. Jack Parsons, one of the early rocket pioneers, but also somebody who was heavily into the teachings of Aleister Crowley and demonology, and essentially blew himself up in his lab in Pasadena in 52 in controversial circumstances. And Hubbard was moving with some intriguing people, all across the board.
In a chapter very close to the L. Ron Hubbard stuff, you get into the Brookings Report. And anybody who's a serious student of ufology, that's one of the first things you come across when you start digging into the paper trail about UFOs is the Brookings report, which synopsized says that it speculates on what would happen if confirmation was achieved, a confirmation of another intelligence, aliens, for example, how would society react? And in a nutshell, the Brookings report didn't have very good things to project. They thought it would create havoc. But you got a chapter on it that goes into a lot more detail about what went into this thing and how they analyzed it. You want to give us a little synopsis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have sort of heard of the Brookings report, but what I tried to do was essentially sort of pick out the important points and demonstrate to people why even, more than 50 years later, this report is so important, because it really does get to the heart of why a genuine UFO phenomenon might be hidden from us. And that's, one of the recommendations is, not so much when we tell the general public, should the general public be told. It also, intriguingly enough, talks about the potential for finding ancient extraterrestrial artifacts within the solar system. Now, of course, today, everybody's heard, regardless of what they think about it, everybody's heard of the face on Mars and reports of ancient structures on Mars and things like this. And you have to wonder, were all the people connected to the Brookings report just guessing, and were they incredibly lucky by saying, well, we may find evidence not of current extraterrestrial life, but evidence that they existed in the distant past? This sort of sounds eerily like the discovery of something like the face on Mars. But the report itself, I mean, it was an ambitious program, the Brookings report. It was like nearly 200 pages long. The grant, to put it all together, was just under $100,000. This was back in the late 50s. It's sort of an incredible amount of money for a report that significantly focused upon extraterrestrial life. And so, in that from that perspective alone, this was a major report. And I think when you look at the recommendations, the fear that how adversely this might impact upon the general population's mindset, that if we're found not to be alone, then you can sort of make a very good argument that this is when the seeds were really sown to put into place some sort of program to deny the general public access to the truth of the UFO phenomenon, whatever it might be.
Well, at the same time, though, a conditioning program in the public sector, meaning, I mean, in the private industry, movies, TV, that the government denying it, and yet we're inundated with this stuff over and over to the point where, I don't know, the Brookings predictions might not be true anymore. We might be ready for it.
Well, we might. And I mean, it's interesting you bring all that up, because just a few years before Brookings, you had the CIA's Robertson panel recommending that the general public should be sort of acclimatized, not to the existence of the UFO phenomenon, but to try and demystify it. And one of the plans they had was to bring the Walt Disney Corporation in to help on the creation of, films and educational sort of cartoons and that kind of thing to put people at ease in relation to UFOs and, steer them away from the idea that the subject was real. So you had a lot of manipulation of the populace, of the public, but you also had a lot of concerns about, well, not just manipulating the information, but just hiding it. So a lot of weird stuff like this was going on in the mid-50s, trying to understand how the human mindset would be affected by exposure to the phenomenon.
And one of the things I found most interesting in this, I had never read before, is that the Brookings folks were speculating that of all the groups, scientists and engineers might be the ones most devastated by the discovery of a superior intelligence or superior creatures. They're the ones that couldn't handle it.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting little point. I mean, we're not entirely sure where all that conclusion comes from, but I think it's an interesting one, because scientists are the sort of people who, they study something very, very deeply and they come to a conclusion which they're pretty sure is the correct one. Those of us in UFO research try to do, we do our research, we're open to different scenarios. Scientists very often will conclude, well, this is the answer, and then to have those answers just sort of blown out of the window, so to speak, you can understand why it would have an adverse effect on them, particularly from, you know, if they've made strong statements, you know, convictions about this or that, then only to have them destroyed, then their reputation's gone. I think that's an important point to remember as to who it actually would impact on the most versus the least, you know.
You touch on two murders that still this day are just heartbreaking to think about it. Robert F. Kennedy, mm-hmm. or presumably by Sirhan Sirhan, and then John Lennon. And, you know, those are separate chapters in the book, but really they're linked. I mean, in a way, they're linked in, there's a common denominator there, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can actually find this through also, you know, Martin Luther King and even to a degree, John F. Kennedy. You know, I've got chapters on all of those. The idea that the assassinations, you know, there may have been a degree of mind control and manipulation involved, and somebody who comes across like a lone gunman may not have been a lone gunman after all. We have, for example, Mark Chapman, I mean, who essentially acted in very strange, almost like a dazed-like fashion when he killed John Lennon. You know, afterwards, he just sat down and waited for the police to arrive.
And started reading. He was reading.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then you had, of course, you know, in the Robert Kennedy assassination, Sirhan Sirhan, you know, his notes where he just written, like, mind control in these pages of his notes. And then, of course, we have, like, Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly defecting to Russia. There's still a lot of, you know, mystery about why he really went to Russia. Theories could have been turned by the Russians and, you know, been like a deep hypnosis sleeper type person sent back and then given one of these so-called trigger words that, you know, prompts him to carry out a pre-planned task. And I think, regardless what people think about these scenarios, in all of these sort of lone assassin situations, we do find, even if it's just a small strand, we always find something that kind of leads to one of these sort of mind control situations. Now, again, you know, some people point the finger at the official agencies. I wonder, again, if it could be sort of like a rogue body with sort of tentacles all around the world influencing major events, but actually sort of doing so in the shadows because they're not actually part of the elected administration. You know?
Yeah, well, RFK, Robert Kennedy would have been a threat to the order of things. John Lennon was perceived as a threat. All the surveillance, FBI surveillance that has been revealed in his FOIA files and you know, and you mentioned about Mark David Chapman sitting down after shooting and killing John Lennon. He sits down and starts reading Catcher in the Rye, which I remember that from the conspiracy theory, the Mel Gibson movie, them making a connection and not realizing that there really is a connection to be made.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of these stories are sort of almost surreal in nature. You know, you find the different connections and the strands of what was going on. You know, I mentioned like Oswald, you know, going to Russia, but not just going to Russia and getting there so easily, but make it so easy for him to come back as well. And people being in the right place at the right time and the wrong place at the wrong time. And you kind of get this, or I get this image of some sort of, you know, as I said, some all-powerful rogue organization, strands all over the place, just essentially doing what it feels needs to be done to keep things on track for this sort of powerful group of elite, if you like,
and bankers.
The rest of us are sort of scratching our heads on the outside looking in, you know.
We're cattle, huh?
Yeah.
You mentioned in the book, of course, a lot of information about MK Ultra, which would fit together with the John Lennon and Sirhan Sirhan scenario that we're talking about here. And I think you write it kind of wryly that MK Ultra ended. You know, considering all the success they had and early indications that this mind control stuff would work, it's kind of hard to believe that it ended.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an important thing to remember, that what happened was that MK Ultra was set up in the early 50s, and it was based around a few projects that began in the late 40s, and then they were sort of unified, and the CIA and the Army got together and began working on all these various programs within, like, the CIA headquarters.
I'll tell you what, Nick, I shouldn't have asked you that question before the break. The music is telling us we need to go to a break. When we come back, we'll pick up the MK Ultra discussion and then open up the phone lines in our final segment with Nick Redfern right after this on Coast to Coast AM. This song is called Soily from Wings. It's a much more robust version than the one that we all heard on the radio. This is from 1977, a movie called One Hand Clapping that was never released, but found this online somewhere. Thought you might like it. We're talking with Nick Redfern about murders, assassinations, schemes, plots, conspiracies and cover-ups, and a lot more covered in his book, Secret History. In a moment, we can open up the phone lines and you can ask him anything you want right here on Coast to Coast AM. Nick Redfern, just to wrap up what we were talking about before the break, MK Ultra. My point was that maybe this is a program officially it ended. You know, it's over. Maybe that's one of the ones like UFOs that was taken somewhere else outside the realm of government.
Yeah, I think you can look at a lot of these issues, George. Where when you look at what was going on in the 50s, it's almost like then it suddenly vanished, and but it would be illogical for it to vanish. You know, I mean. For example, we know that the UFO subject was heavily investigated by the military in the 50s, and then we're told that it all came to an end when Project Blue Book shut down in 69. And it's kind of almost like a identical parallel with MKUltra, that it was reportedly shut down in the 70s and everything was brought to a halt. You do have to wonder if, again, you know, these sort of shadow agencies have taken control of all these different things, and it's just not being seen for what it is. But one of the interesting things about MKUltra is that, you know, the elected government really didn't know too much about it until the mid-70s, and that was when investigations began into it, and Richard Helms, who was the director of the CIA at the time, actually ordered all the files to be burned, and literally, you know, boxes and boxes, thousands, tens of thousands of pages were relegated to the furnace at the CIA's, one of their facilities. And so we'll never really know to what extent, you know, and scope that material covered. But fortunately, a lot of documents did survive the destruction, particularly documents that had been sent out to, you know, private contractors that did work on the program. So we have a substantial sort of input on the story, but parts of it we'll never really know today. They're just totally lost.
You look at the big picture, you read your book, Secret History, cover to cover, and it becomes depressing, disillusioning in some ways, when you realize that a lot of really bad things have been done in secrecy. They were done for years, involving thousands of people. No one knew about it until years later. Some really truly bad stuff in the name of national security, and sometimes we just found out about it through luck. I mean, the idea that secrets cannot be kept, that conspiracies are not real, it's simply not true. I just wonder, do you ever get disillusioned by the prospect that the people who do this kind of stuff are better at their job than you and I or people like us are at ferreting it out?
No, I actually don't get disillusioned. I guess it spurs me on more to get the answers. You know, I think you can look at some of these things and you can go one or two ways. You can think, oh my God, you know, it's out of our hands and the world's just, you know, a terrible place and people get depressed. Or you can feel galvanized and enthused and energized to look into these things further. And that's the angle that, you know, I kind of fall into.
Let's take some calls. First-time caller, Jarrett in Lake County, California. Hi, Jarrett. Welcome to the program. You're on with Nick Redfern.
Thanks, George, for taking my call. First-time caller. I've been a fan of the show for a long time. And I've read some of your stuff, Nick. I appreciate your interest, and I'm one of those, too, that have been interested in a lot of things. This might be off topic, but I'll just bring it up, and then I'll take any answers off the air so we get more time for more callers. I'm interested in the Malta situation with those ancient roads and those ancient structures that they found out by Malta on that island with the grooves in the bedrock and that. And apparently those are older than the pyramids. So If you could comment on that real quick, I know it's off topic, that'd be great. I appreciate the time, and I'll take the answers off call. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jarrett. I don't know anything about that, Nick. I hope you do.
I actually don't. I've not heard of that one at all.
Sorry, Jarrett. You're going to have to share. You're going to have to call back and let us know a little bit more about it, or we're going to have to look into it and book some guests who are on top of that one. Thanks for the call. Wildcard line, Gordon in Lakeland, Florida. Good morning, Gordon. You're on with Nick Redfern.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, George and Nick. Earlier, Nick mentioned the Ark of the Covenant, and I just wanted to mention that one thing he failed to mention was that it could be radioactive. But the main reason I wanted to call is because that I believe it was first hour that you said that your next guest, which would be Nick, said that there's the government is actually not democratic and it's not responsive to the will of the people. And I found a scientific study called Testing Theories of American Politics. It's by Gilens and Page, G-I-L-E-N-S, Martin Gilens and Ben Page. And it basically showed scientific evidence, and they did a scientific study from Princeton, I believe, and these liberals normally would be all for the government, but even they found that while the will of the people is usually reflected by the government, that's only because the people that are pulling the strings are the ones that usually agree with the will of the people. But in cases where it differs, the will of the people is never, it has absolutely no statistical influence, okay? And I have actually one example of that. For example, college loans and college debt is out of control, and most people want the college students to not be overburdened with this, but the few people that are in power don't. And this is one case where the will of the masses is in direct opposition to the rich people. And I wanted to find out if it would be all right that I throw out my website of where I've researched that to where you can take a closer look at it.
Okay. Well, you're here.
I'm Gordon Watts, and if you go to GordonWayneWatts.com or GordonWatts.com, and at the top there's the higher education link. You click the higher education link, and when you get down there, you can find out that this is actually probably unconstitutional. It's very unfair. They've changed the laws. And anyone that is in college or knows someone in college or has studied this knows that it's no longer affordable.
All right, Gordon. Thank you. I appreciate the call. You got your plug there. I actually, to correct you, I didn't say that the second guest would be talking about the faux elections and the fact that democracy doesn't really work. It was an article that we posted on the NAPS News section on the Coast website. I don't know if you want to get into that at all, Nick, or have any thoughts on the general topic. If not, we'll move on.
Well, I'm not sort of overly familiar with I know the sort of the plight that the students are under. I'm not sort of fully aware of all the intricacies, but it is sort of a very sort of bleak situation when you're straight out of college and, you know, you're looking for work and you're faced with this gigantic debt. You know, it's can't be much fun to have that hanging over your head, you know.
The larger issue was whether or not democracy is a sham or not, that people go to the polls, they vote, they elect somebody like Obama. You think he's going to do something different from George Bush, and it ends up doing the same or more of the same. And
in England, when I'd vote and you hear promises and from the Prime Minister, promises on that, and the other guy says, well, I promised this, and then they get elected, and before you know it, the promises have gone out the window. And you can understand why people do become disillusioned and frustrated. I mean, that's politics, you know, unfortunately. The thing is, how do we get around that? You know, can't we just have it, you know, the way it should be?
Well, here's, it makes you wonder, is there a new president is elected, and then somebody has a meeting, okay, here's the way it's going to be. And then they show some video of JFK's head being blown off as a reminder of who calls the shots, literally and figuratively. And then they do the bidding of whoever the other people are. You wrote the book on conspiracies. I'm just blabbing about it.
Well, yeah, I think, a lot goes on behind the scenes that we don't know. And of course, with any elected leader, prime minister, president, they can only act on the data that's provided to them by their advisors. You know, they can't know everything about everything, so they get briefings here and there. Who provides the briefing? Where does the data come from? You know, that was One of the big issues with the whole weapons of mass destruction controversy was, you know, decisions were made based upon data provided, and then people down the line said, well, the data was faulty, and so it's not the fault of this person and that person, it's the original intelligence data, that kind of thing. So in other words, you know, it's when we're looking at who's making the decisions, who's got the policy decisions, a lot of it is sort of just based upon data and reaching a conclusion or a goal based on what you're told, and that applies to presidents and prime ministers. They make a decision based on what they're told, but what they're told, you know, how correct is that data itself?
Right. All right, we're going to go back to the phone lines. Folks, we have just this segment remaining. Let's keep our eye on the ball here. East of the Rockies, Jim, who is trucking in Mississippi. Hey, Jim, you're on with Nick Redfern.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you very much for taking my call. Nick, my question is, you're from England, if I heard that properly.
Yeah.
Back in the 50s, there's a gentleman named John R.R. Searle that came up with the Searle effect generator and consequently the Searle levity disk.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I understand and read on the internet, it sounds like he got thrown in jail, and while he was in jail, all of his workshop and everything burnt to the ground. Do you know of any of this, or if it's part of your conspiracy theory stuff? I'm going to turn my radio up and hang up, but I thank you both for your time, and I hope you have a wonderful night.
Thanks, Jim. Drive safely out there.
Yeah, the story of John Searle is an interesting one. He was a guy who was fascinated by advanced technologies and even what you could call like flying saucer type technology. And, you know, this is a thread that we find throughout a lot of conspiracy theories, the idea of somebody coming up with alternative technologies, fuel, energy, alternative means of travel, that kind of thing. And they sort of get shut down or they have problems, and, you know, the sort of the status quo steps in to keep the official balance, so to speak. And I mean, we find that in sort of the John Searle story of alternative energies. We find it with like Wilhelm Reich, with his orgone research and that kind of thing, ended up in jail and, you know, his papers destroyed. Alternative energy and things like this about, you know, people coming up with alternative energy ideas, and they're then subjected to such stringent tests and checks that...
Do you have a theory about whether Searle was the real deal?
Oh, yeah, I actually think he was. I think he was. I think, you know, this was a guy who had some fascinating alternative scenarios on energy, on power, on, you know, doing away with sort of cumbersome technologies that we rely on today. And but again, a lot of it just comes down, you know, to the like I said, the status quo. The oil industry today, I mean, is still so powerful and overriding that it sort of eclipses anything else purely due to the whole profit angle. You know, it's just a case of, you know, sustaining the profits, really.
Back to the phones, a wild card line, John in Long Beach, California. Hi, John, you're on with Nick Redfern.
Hey, great to be on again. There's a mystery I want you to solve for me. Is how is it you put six socks in the washing machine and only five come out? You figure that out, and you'll have a big bestseller.
It's the ultimate conspiracy. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys, why would it? Okay, we have this powerful government force that won't let presidents talk about UFOs and won't let them do the research. First of all, in your mind, either one of you guys, who are these people that exists above and beyond, you know, if you could identify them? And what is their true, I know there's a lot of reasons they think religion wouldn't mean as much, going to work wouldn't mean as much, and we found out, you know, a lot of institutions wouldn't, including scientists who have their own religion of the sort. But what is the main reason in your guys' mind or primary reason why they try to keep it from us, if it's true that there are UFOs and there are beings from other you know, dimensions or planets? What is their main reason for doing that? And I'll listen off the air.
Okay.
All right. Well, yeah, as far as who they are, I mean, there is solid evidence, not just theory, solid evidence of like black budget programs where the, you know, the financing comes through obscure means by which sometimes even, you know, elected agencies and officials and Congress, you know, congressional oversight just doesn't apply. They don't know anything about it. Very often these are sort of like think tank type groups that are sort of quasi connected to government. Very often it involves work that's farmed out to private corporations, and of course that happens more and more today, you know, where advanced technology research is undertaken for military agencies, but it's not undertaken by the military, it's undertaken by private corporations. And of course private corporations aren't subject to the Freedom of Information Act, so that can make it harder to access materials. You know, and so I think that's one of the ways in which, you know, secrets can be kept. Now, as to why the secrets are being kept, I think, you know, that there are these issues of things impacting on religion and how would the public react. But I do think a lot of it comes down to economic issues, you know, sort of the fraught state in the Middle East, the best of times, you know, the oil industry, so the fragile state of the economy. And the UFO subject potentially has the possibility to impact on all of this if the, with the introduction of new technologies and things like this, to where the existing order could be completely overthrown. And the people in control of the existing order don't want to be overthrown. It really is that simple, I think.
I sort of lean toward it boils down to the money elite. Corporations, not governments, run the world.
Yeah,
money runs the
world.
That's
one of the strands I talk about in the book, this theme that, you know, as I said earlier, a lot of people point the finger at the and say the governments are the bad guys. I actually don't think that. I really do believe there are, like, very powerful, influential groups that operate outside of the law, outside of governments. Governments aren't necessarily even aware of them, and they have their strands and their, you know, octopus-like tentacles here and there, and they're the real manipulators of the planet, not, you know, the elected governments.
Yeah, I don't even think the presidents know about UFOs. I know that, you know, Bill Clinton, for example, Jimmy Carter made inquiries. They wanted to know. The answer comes back, well, there's nothing there, sorry, and then how far can they take it? There's not many options left to them. So I agree with Nick that whatever evidence and physical evidence about UFOs or crashed saucers or technology that's been recovered, it's outside the purview of government to begin with. We'll try to get to one more call. Let's go to west of the Rockies, Mike in Costa Mesa. Hi, Mike. Better make it a quick
yeah,
one.
Good evening, gentlemen. Longtime listener and excellent program tonight. When you speak of Sirhan and Chapman, we're talking about a Manchurian candidate situation. Were you aware that either one of you, that Frank Sinatra, who was in the movie The Manchurian Candidate and is one of the producers, he actually owned the movie, appeared on the Johnny Carson show? And both of them, I know the body language of both of them. I was a big fan of Johnny Carson. They were very uneasy, and the subject of The Manchurian Candidate was brought up. And Sinatra was very uneasy, saying, yeah, everybody keeps asking me about The Manchurian Candidate. I don't know. I talked to my agent. I talked to this. And finally, he talked to the owner. He says, well, it's sitting on the shelf. You own it. And it was very contrived. Are you guys aware of that? Because Frank Sinatra was under possible indictment for his mafia connections with the Vegas.
I'll tell you what, Mike, I'm going to have to cut you off on that. Let Nick react because we're about out of time. Nick,
yeah, I actually didn't know about that, the Carson interview with Sinatra. But, yeah, I mean, you know, Frank Sinatra was an interesting guy, not just, you know, for the Rat Pack of his career, but also, you know, the mafia links and, you know, the Manchurian Candidate is a genuinely sort of, the original one is sort of really weird and intriguing, surreal movie, you know, the idea of what's reality, you know, and how it can be manipulated, how the mind can be manipulated. And you know, I mean, maybe he knew more, maybe he had a vested interest in wanting to get that film out, you know, get the story out there perhaps.
Well, what we know about MK Ultra now, so much of it seems more than just a movie. Nick Redfern, always good to talk to you. The new book, Secret History, Conspiracies, Ancient Aliens, New World Order, is a hit. It's good stuff.
Thanks, George.
I'll talk to you again. I want to thank my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Gina Salvati, Jeff DeRay, Webmaster Lex, Dan Galani, Chris Boros, and my earlier guest, Bill Grabowski. I'll be back next Sunday. Good night, everyone.